This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents American Wolf, a true story of survival and obsession in the West by Nate Blakesley. Read for you by Mark Bramhall, with an epilogue read by the author. It would be so lovely to not have to follow the scents of the politics, the laws, the cattle, the humans, the hunters, the roads. It would be so lovely to just stay in the dark woods and concentrate only on pure, unencumbered biology, foot sizes and body weights, diets, range and distribution. It would also be fiction. Rick Bass, The 9 Mile Wolves. No beast so fierce but knows some touch of pity, but I know none, and therefore am no beast. Richard III. All stories are about wolves, all worth repeating, that is. Anything else is sentimental drivel. Think about it. There's escaping from the wolves, fighting the wolves, capturing the wolves, taming the wolves, being thrown to the wolves, or throwing others to the wolves so the wolves will eat them instead of you, running with the wolf pack, turning into a wolf, best of all turning into the head wolf. No other decent stories exist. Margaret Atwood, The Blind Assassin. Author's Note. Every scene depicting wolves in this book was drawn from contemporaneous observations. I could not have accomplished this without the generous cooperation of Lori Lyman, who lent me her notes, some 2,500 pages, on the wolves of Yellowstone's northern range. Lori's daily observations, supplemented on the occasions when she was absent from the park with notes she collected from friends, allowed me to get to know the Lamar Canyon pack, and they form the basis for my descriptions of the life of 06 and her family. Rick McIntyre graciously provided me copies of his own notes from key moments in the life of the pack, which, along with my interviews with other observers, allowed me to draw those scenes more fully. Rick and Lori's cooperation should not be construed as an endorsement of the ideas about wolves or people found in these pages. Those are my own. Finally, the names and identifying characteristics of two individuals, referred to in this account as Stephen and Wayne Turnbull, have been changed to protect their privacy. Prologue, December 6, 2012. The hunter left his truck at the end of the gravel road and trudged into the fresh December snow. He was a broad-chested, clear-eyed man of middle age, wearing a brown Carhartt sweatshirt and heavy winter boots. The snow before him, tinted blue by the soft early morning light, was crisscrossed with wolf tracks, and he followed them to the edge of an open field. Beyond it, perhaps a quarter of a mile away, was a steep, heavily forested ridge, and to his right another peak loomed, blocking out the morning sun. On a cord around the hunter's thick neck hung a brown plastic whistle, shaped like a chess pawn. He put it to his lips and blew a series of short bursts, covering and uncovering the small fluted horn on the end, mimicking the wail of a dying cottontail rabbit. It resembled nothing so much as the cry of a colicky baby, a noise he had not heard in 25 years. He waited half a minute, then sent another call floating through the thin mountain air, shrill and defiant at first, then tapering off into whimpering acceptance. You had to make it sound real. That was what most people didn't understand. Just blasting away on the call like a kazoo would get you nowhere. The trick was to imagine what it would be like to be eaten alive by a coyote, the horror and pain of that kind of death. And you had to be patient. He'd been stalking the pack for weeks, sighting a wolf or two here and there, but never getting close enough for a shot. He'd howled them the night before, using nothing more than his cupped hands and his own voice, and had eventually heard a response. They hadn't been far, and they weren't far now. He waited. His name was Stephen Turnbull, and he was in a valley known as Crandall, deep in the Absaroka Mountains northwest of Cody, Wyoming. The Clark's Fork of the Yellowstone River flowed through a narrow canyon at the western end of the valley, opening up into a wide, flat basin ringed with lodgepole pine, where it was joined by Crandall Creek, cascading down from the mountains bordering Yellowstone National Park. The creek was named for a gold prospector who was killed by Indians while making his way to a promising placer mine near the headwaters of the Clark's Fork in the spring of 1870. With the nearest settlement at least 20 miles away, the bodies of Marvin J. Crandall and his partner were not found until the following spring, when a search party came upon their severed heads, said to have been mounted on their own picks on the banks of the creek. Crandall was still a difficult place to reach, especially in winter. It was served only by a single road, the 2-lane Chief Joseph Highway. In summer, the winding road provided a scenic route from Cody through the Shoshone National Forest to Yellowstone, which lay about 20 miles west of the basin as the crow flies, over some of the most rugged terrain in the northern Rockies. In winter, the snowplows went no farther than Crandall's western edge. Travel to Yellowstone required a snowmobile. No more than 50 people lived in the valley year-round, raising cattle or running one of a handful of guest ranches or hunting outfitters. A single store, known as the Painter Outpost, sold breakfast and beer, catering in winter mostly to snowmobilers and hunters, and in summer to the few Yellowstone-bound tourists determined enough to take the less traveled route to the park. Yellowstone became a national park, the nation's first, shortly after Marvin Crandall and his fellow prospectors arrived, which theoretically protected its resources from the great wave of western migration that washed over the Rocky Mountains by the end of the 19th century. In reality, the fur traders who inundated the park ignored the designation, along with almost everything else that originated in Washington, D.C. Now Yellowstone was overrun with tourists, at least in summer. Turnbull seldom spent time there. The park was for visitors. Crandall, especially in winter, covered with 3 feet of snow, was the real Wyoming. Yellowstone did have one thing he loved, however, and that was elk. Every winter, massive herds migrated out of the park, leaving the high country for lower, less snowy pastures. Some of them followed the Clark's Fork drainage east as it wound its way down into Crandall, which became a game highway for months at a time. Turnbull had lost track of how many elk he had taken in this valley over the years. But it wasn't like it used to be, not since the wolves had come back to Yellowstone. The elk had once paraded down into the basin every winter, some years as many as 1,000. You could pick the animal you wanted to shoot, almost like ordering from a catalog. Now you were lucky to see 200 in the valley all winter, and the state of Wyoming had begun rationing elk tags by lottery. The wolves took the rest. Over the last 15 years, the wolves had spread well beyond the borders of the park, where the first few packs were reintroduced by federal wildlife officials back in the mid-1990s. Like most people he knew, Turnbull had been against the plan from the beginning, and he thought there were now far too many wolves in Wyoming. But of course, nobody had asked him for his opinion. It was the same with grizzlies. When he was a kid, he could throw down a bedroll and sleep on the ground anywhere in Crandall. He would never do that now. After decades of federal protection, the woods were full of bears, so many that you didn't even have to be in the back country to spot them. You saw them from the road. People saw them right outside their cabins when they stepped onto their porches in the morning. To be safe, Turnbull always carried a .44 Magnum pistol with him in the woods, even in hunting season, when you weren't really supposed to. The grizzlies claimed their share of game, too, especially newborn elk and moose, but nothing like what the wolves took. The wildlife experts in Yellowstone claimed game numbers were down because of drought more than anything else, but Turnbull didn't buy it. It was the wolves. He'd seen the chewed-up carcasses in the woods with his own eyes. Hunting big game was what life in Wyoming was all about, as far as Turnbull was concerned. He couldn't remember the last time he'd bought beef at a grocery store. He might pick up a little suet from time to time to help make lean elk meat into good burger. But meat, to him, meant elk. Even though hardwood was difficult to come by in his part of the world, he always found what he needed to smoke his own jerky every winter. With a healthy dose of coarse black pepper and a little garlic, there was nothing like it. He bagged it up and gave it to his friends, at least those who didn't already have sacks full of it themselves. He wasn't in the woods every fall just for the meat. He loved the elk, and he loved the mountains they called home. He had a house about an hour's drive east in a small farming town, but he spent most of his time at his cabin in Crandall, supporting himself with any work he could find nearby, painting cabins in the summer, acting as a caretaker for those same places in the winter, cutting firewood, manual labor of various kinds. His grandfather had started taking him hunting for rabbit and duck in the backcountry around Cody when he was 5 years old. When he was a teenager, he'd hunted with his mother's old .30-40 Krag, the rifle of choice for the U.S. Army before World War I. He wasn't sure how old the gun was, but it had been given as a wedding present to his maternal grandfather, who then handed it down to his daughter on the occasion of her own wedding. It was reliable only up to 100 yards or so, with a muzzle speed so slow you could practically see the bullet coming out of the barrel. Turnbull's sister had asked for it after their parents died, and he hadn't argued. He had a much better rifle slung over his shoulder now, but he didn't use that much. He was mainly a bow hunter these days. He'd killed moose, black bear, 800-pound bull elk, any kind of big game you could find in these mountains, with his bow. He loved the elegance of the bow, the same weapon, albeit greatly refined, that Indians had used to hunt elk in these very woods for hundreds of years. He'd always been taught to get as close to an animal as you could before you took your shot, and leaving your rifle at home ensured that your stalking skills would be tested. He watched all the hunting shows and read all the magazines, and he'd noticed that these days the emphasis seemed to be on long-range shooting. A manufacturer in Cody made a rifle that could supposedly kill an elk at 1,000 yards. To Turnbull, that wasn't ethical. For him, fair chase, the notion that a hunter should eschew any technique that gave him or her an improper advantage over game, was more than just an empty slogan. The other good thing about bow hunting was that the archery season for elk began in September, a month before the general rifle hunt, which meant you could get out in the woods when they were still relatively devoid of other hunters. Crandall had become increasingly popular with out-of-towners in recent years, and there were guide services in the area catering to wealthy clients, though not as many as there once were, when the elk were more plentiful. Private ranches along the Clark's Fork were world-famous for their lightly hunted herds and their enormous bulls. He couldn't afford to hunt at those places, and he didn't care. Most of Crandall was national forest land, where anybody could hunt for the price of a $50 elk tag, assuming you could get one. The start of bow hunting season was his favorite time to be in the woods. The weather in September was still beautiful, with warm days and nights chilly enough to bring out the fall color in the aspens, cottonwoods, and willows. The bulls were rutting then, bugling to the cows in their harems and butting heads with their rivals. You had to get the meat out fast, as temperatures were warm enough to be a concern, though you couldn't really leave your kill out overnight anyway because of the bears. When you got back the next morning, there'd be nothing left of your elk, or worse, You'd find a 700-pound grizzly lying on top of it. October meant the rifle hunt for bulls, followed by antlerless elk, usually beginning in mid-November. By the end of December, the season was over. But Turnbull still found excuses to get out into the woods. He'd stalk elk with his video camera, filming the big bulls in his favorite spots, getting to know them by their racks. In late winter, he'd go out and collect shed antlers, occasionally trying to match them with the bulls on his recordings. The woods were full of sheds, and he'd fill his pickup and sell them by the pound in town. They usually ended up as meal for animal feed. Black bear season came in the spring, and in the summer he kept himself sharp with archery practice, fletching his own arrows. It was the only time of year you could shoot at targets without losing arrows in the snow. You couldn't shoot a grizzly, not legally, anyway. But now you could, at long last, shoot a wolf. He wasn't sure why it had taken so long for the bureaucrats in Cheyenne and Washington to see what had long been obvious to him. It wasn't that he minded seeing wolves in Crandall. Unlike some of his cowboy friends, who, given the opportunity, would have killed every last one of them to protect their stock, he believed they had a place on the landscape, but they needed to be controlled. When Wyoming's first legal wolf hunting season in more than 50 years was announced that fall, game officials had set a limit of 8 in this part of the Shoshone National Forest, and Turnbull had been among the first in Crandall to pay the $12 for a wolf tag. Now, 12 weeks into the hunt, 7 wolves had already been taken, and the tag was still in his pocket, unfilled. He planned on getting the last wolf. It was getting close to 7 o'clock when 2 wolves stepped out of the willows along the edge of the field. They were perhaps 200 yards away, moving in tandem across the virgin snow. One was all black, and so large he could only be a male in his prime. The other, his mate, Turnbull guessed, was a gray. She was smaller, but still a good-sized wolf. Her thick winter pelage was white underneath, darkening to gray along the flanks. The long guard hairs on her back and shoulders were stippled with black, like a cape. At this distance, the gray might have been mistaken for somebody's lost Malamute, had she not been standing next to her dark companion, who resembled nothing else under the sun but what he clearly was. The wolves spotted the hunter immediately, but didn't run. He slowly raised his rifle to his shoulder and sighted through the scope. He had time to choose between them. Chapter 1. Return of the Wolf. The wolves drove an elk down the side of a steep, snow-covered butte under a sky close and gray. There were 3 wolves. The one in the lead was almost pure white. She was followed closely by her sister, a good-sized gray. Several yards back and struggling to keep up was a mature black male, his snout and withers gone silver with age. The elk had been one of many cows atop the butte. Now she was alone, hurtling pell-mell toward the broad valley below, dodging the lichen-covered glacial erratics, some the size of small cabins, that dotted the hillside, leaping over what she could and exploding straight through the sage and juniper. It was early winter, and the snow was not yet deep, offering the kind of footing that favored the elk. For such an enormous animal, at least 5 times heavier than any of her pursuers, she was surprisingly fast and nimble. Her chocolate ears laid back against her head, her bouncing ovoid rump the same shade of buff as the sedge poking up through the snow, she seemed an impossible quarry. The cow headed for the river, as her kind often did when the wolves came. The deep water offered long-legged animals an advantage. A swimming wolf has no leverage for biting and pulling. Chases often ended in stalemate this way, with an elk standing in hip-deep water, warily eyeing a pack of wolves lounging on the nearby bank as they patiently waited to see if the frigid water would force the elk back onto dry land. The refuge the cow sought was the Lamar River, not far from where it joined the Yellowstone, and on this winter morning it was frozen solid. Perhaps she didn't know that, or perhaps in her panic she could think of nowhere else to go. It was only 500 yards or so from the base of the butte to the river, but once the chase reached level ground, the wolves began to close the gap. The four animals were now in single file, running flat out, pounding the snow into a fine, powdery spray like the dust under a racehorse's hooves. The contest had become purely a matter of speed, and the canines, the primordial ancestors of the greyhound, unsullied by the inbreeding that stripped away the tiger-muscled shoulders, the massive head, the powerful jaws, ran with a raw and joyous energy that the ungulate could not match. As the race neared its climax, it was the grey who stood out. Her body seemed to stretch and elongate as the ground swept beneath her. Her legs were long, much longer than a dog's, and her hips narrow like a cheetah's. She held her tail straight out, and her head was a flattened triangle. She was an arrow, and by comparison the elk suddenly seemed not only clumsy, but also excessively, sadly, fatally, upright. Every time the cow missed a step, stumbling slightly in a pocket of deep snow, she had less time to recover, until finally there was no time at all. The wolves pulled her down in a frozen marsh between two icy ponds. About a quarter of a mile away, a man stood on the side of a road watching the wolves eat. His name was Rick McIntyre, and he worked for the National Park Service. Bundled in a heavy black down coat that extended past his waist, only the familiar forest green of his pants marked him as a park employee. He was in an area of Yellowstone known as Little America, where the Lamar River swept through a series of low hills and rocky knolls in the park's mountainous northern range. Rick was 60 years old, though with his ramrod posture and tall, lean frame, his age was hard to guess, especially with a stocking cap covering his thinning red hair. He was surveying the scene through a spotting scope, a kind of tripod-mounted telescope used for watching wildlife. Every so often he reached inside his coat and pulled a microcassette recorder from the breast pocket of his uniform and described what he was seeing. Just a few words, economical and to the point. Then the recorder disappeared back into the coat. For the most part, he stood motionless behind his scope, silently watching. It was 9 a.m. on December 12, 2009. And it was the 3,467th day in a row that he had spent in the park looking for wolves. It was getting close to lunchtime for Rick, who had been awake since about 4 that morning. The wolves were often active at dawn, and he liked to be in place when the landscape first became visible, about a half hour before actual sunrise. Both the male and the white female in his scope, a mated pair, wore thick leather collars with radio transmitters attached, which was how he'd found them. Every pack in Yellowstone had at least one wolf that had been darted from a helicopter, collared, and assigned a number by the park's small team of wolf biologists. Each morning, Rick drove until the antenna on the roof of his yellow Nissan SUV picked up a wolf's unique signal, and then he stepped out into the darkness to scan the nearby landscape with his handheld receiver. As he watched the trio of wolves tugging at the elk carcass, Rick found his eye drawn back to the gray female. She had no collar, which meant she had not been given a number, but she did have a nickname, 06, for the year in which she had been born. At this range, his scope revealed every detail. She might as well have been sitting at his feet. She was a wonderful specimen, with a dense coat and a heavier physique than most females, who averaged around 90 pounds. Not much usually distinguished one black wolf from another, but every gray was different. 06 had unusually attractive markings, a faint black oval around each eye, offset by twin wedges of white along the bridge of her nose. Her cheeks were also white, and an unbroken streak of gray ran from the tip of her head to the end of her nose, tapering off into buff along the sides of her snout. The overall effect was of a vaguely owl-like mask, which gave her a look of quiet concentration. She had been born a member of the Agate Creek Pack, in a den about 5 miles to the south, not far from where Agate Creek spilled into the chossy, sulphurous canyon that held the Yellowstone River. After leaving her pack as a yearling, she had been more or less on the run for the last 2 years, looking for a mate and a territory of her own. So far, she had been unsuccessful. Rick had observed her mating with 5 different males the previous winter without settling down with any of them, which was unusual behavior for a lone female. It was also hazardous. Young wolves had to leave their natal packs in order to find a mate, but outside their home territory, alone, they were in constant danger. Almost every part of Yellowstone's landscape belonged to one pack or another, and the various tribes patrolled their holdings relentlessly. Lone wolves caught trespassing could count on being chased, and entire packs occasionally clashed with one another, especially along the borders of adjoining territories. Territorial conflict was the most common cause of death for the park's wolves, most of whom didn't live beyond 4 or 5 years. Life for wolves was an adventure, but it was usually not a long one. At 3 and a half, O6 had already reached middle age. Unless she found a mate soon, her prospects for survival were not good. Had she been a male, it might have been different. Young males unable to find a mate were sometimes accepted into other packs. Such subordinate males were generally not allowed to breed. Only the alpha male had that privilege. But they at least had a chance to take over from an aging alpha one day. Packs usually had just a single breeding female, the alpha, who tended to reject any newcomer who might bear pups of her own. Few lone wolves of either gender ever found what they were seeking. They either returned to their natal pack or died alone, far from home. Yet O6 had a knack for not getting caught, and her moxie had made her one of Rick's favorites. In recent months, she'd been tagging along with the collared pair in his scope, one of whom was her older sister and the other an unrelated male, as they hunted the outer reaches of Agate territory, pushing farther and farther north in search of unclaimed habitat. It was an arrangement unlikely to last. O6 was an outstanding hunter, which made her an asset to her companions, but there wasn't much in the deal for her. Once her sister had pups with her new mate in the spring, she would be the alpha female of their new pack. O6 would have to defer to her in every regard for as long as she remained healthy and fit to breed. Rick couldn't imagine it. O6 simply didn't fit the mold of the beta female, content to wait her turn for a chance to lead and to have pups of her own. She didn't have the temperament for it. O6's great-grandmother had been one of the first wolves reintroduced to the park, captured on the plains of western Canada, 800 miles to the north, and ferried south by plane and truck in the winter of 1995. By that time, Yellowstone had been essentially devoid of wolves for almost 7 decades. Once found in virtually every habitat between the Arctic Circle and present-day Mexico City, gray wolves had been the target of a centuries-long campaign of trapping and poisoning, a war waged both for their valuable pelts and to protect livestock. They were all but eliminated by the 1920s across the vast majority of the lower 48. The last wolves believed to have been born in Yellowstone, a pair of pups discovered near Soda Butte Creek, about 15 miles east of where Rick was now standing, were shot in 1926. They were killed not by poachers, but by park rangers. Almost from the time the park was created, in 1872, early superintendents had pursued a rigorous predator control program aimed chiefly at protecting the big game animals, elk, antelope, moose, and bighorn sheep, that were considered Yellowstone's prime attractions. Rangers patrolling on horseback finished the job the trappers had started, finding active dens, destroying the pups, and then trapping or tracking the returning adults so they could be killed as well. As a science, wildlife management was still in its infancy, and park officials genuinely believed that predators would eventually decimate the park's prey population if left to their own devices. They didn't realize that wolves and elk had coexisted in Yellowstone for thousands of years, that the two species had in fact evolved in tandem with each other, which explained why the elk could run just as fast as the wolf, but no faster. Wolves were the driving force behind the evolution of a wide variety of prey species in North America after the last ice age, literally molding the natural world around them. The massive size of the moose, the nimbleness of the white-tailed deer, the uncanny balance of the bighorn sheep, the architect of these and countless other marvels, was the wolf. Nor did Yellowstone's early managers understand what would happen to an ecosystem without predators. Once the wolves were gone, the ungulate population in the park exploded, and the quality of the range quickly began to deteriorate. Overgrazed hillsides eroded, and stream banks denuded of woody shrubs began to crumble, damaging prime trout habitat. Elk, browsing at their leisure, undisturbed by predators, decimated stands of young aspen and willow. Too many animals on the landscape brought starvation and disease, and the elk population followed a boom-and-bust cycle. By the 1930s, Yellowstone officials had no choice but to do what they had done with the wolves. They started quietly culling the park's enormous elk herds, shooting thousands of animals in an average year, usually in the winter when few visitors were around to see the carnage. This continued until the 1960s, when hunters in areas adjacent to the park pressured their elected officials to intervene. Fewer elk in Yellowstone, they knew, meant fewer elk migrating out of the park in winter, which in turn meant fewer hunting opportunities. The elk population was once again allowed to grow untrammeled. The idea that wolves might be the solution to Yellowstone's problems surfaced as early as 1940, though it wasn't until the 1970s that the federal government began seriously considering reintroduction. Elected officials in Idaho, Wyoming, and Montana, the states surrounding the park, were adamantly opposed to the idea, in deference to two constituencies that exercised an outsized influence on local politics: ranchers and hunters. Ranchers, whose own ancestors had helped rid the mountains of predators in the first place, feared they'd lose livestock once the reintroduced wolves began spreading beyond the park's boundaries. Elk hunters, meanwhile, knew the wolves would be subsisting on the same game they cherished, and they'd only just won the fight to keep rangers from reducing elk numbers. From the hunter's perspective, every elk taken by a wolf was a lost opportunity, and wolves ate a lot of elk. Hunting was big business in the Northern Rockies, not just for the professional hunting guides who relied on a steady stream of clients to earn a living, but also for the restaurants and motels that hosted the influx of out-of-town hunters who arrived every fall. As an endangered species, wolves would be protected even when they weren't in Yellowstone, but in order to get the states on board, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service had made a promise. As soon as the reintroduced wolf population was sufficiently numerous and stable, the wolf would be taken off the endangered species list, and the states could manage their respective populations however they wished. It was understood that this would eventually mean an annual hunting season for wolves. Still, opponents of reintroduction fought literally to the very last minute, delaying the opening of the wolves' cages as a federal judge considered their final pleadings. In the end, proponents of reintroduction won, and the wolves were released in the park with great fanfare. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt and Fish and Wildlife Service Director Molly Beatty personally helped carry the cages the final stretch through the deep January snow to the release point. The Yellowstone wolves were fitted with radio collars and initially set loose into three acclimation pens, each about an acre in size. Project leaders hoped the period of adjustment afforded by the pens would make it less likely that the wolves would take off for home once they were set free. The truth was, nobody really knew what would happen. No one had ever tried this before. Within a month of opening the pens in March 1995, the project lost its first wolf. Known as Ten, he was by far the most stunning animal brought down from Canada, the very epitome of an alpha male. Just getting him sedated so that he could be collared was a challenge. He grabbed the jab stick holding the needle and snapped it in his jaws, not once, but twice. Most of the other captured wolves were scared senseless when humans approached, but Ten had the unsettling habit of staring his captors in the eyes. The project biologists placed him in an acclimation pen with Wolf 9, a mature female, and her adult daughter, Wolf 7, though whether the trio would bond under such artificial circumstances was far from certain. To the researchers' surprise, 9 and 10 mated even before leaving the pen. The trio, now a nascent pack, was released with high hopes that as the wolves settled into the park, a new litter, the first born in Yellowstone in decades, would soon follow. But Ten and his pregnant companion struck out north over Druid Peak, heading out of Yellowstone and into the heart of the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness, with Seven in tow. 2 days later, Doug Smith, the project's chief biologist, picked up their signal from a small plane. They were high above the tree line in the rugged Absaroka Mountains, headed for the even higher Beartooth Plateau. It was the kind of place only a wolf could reach in winter, a 10,000-foot-high, treeless, craggy wasteland. But it was unlikely these wolves, hailing as they did from the plains of western Canada, had ever encountered anything like it. The long-term goal of the reintroduction project was that dispersing wolves would gradually recolonize the wilderness surrounding the park, a 20-million-acre expanse known as the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem. But not in the first week, and not before the national park itself, free from poachers, livestock, and busy highways, had been repopulated. Eventually, the trio came back to the park, but immediately after their return, bad weather prevented Smith from flying for 11 agonizing days. The pack's whereabouts were unknown. When the wolves were finally located, Seven hadn't gone far, but it seemed that the alphas had traveled out of the park once more, 40 miles northeast, to where the Absarokas end and Montana's central plains begin, near a town called Red Lodge. The signal from Nine's collar suggested she was in a reasonably accessible spot on the side of a peak known as Mount Maurice. But Ten's transmitter was beeping twice as fast as normal. Mortality mode. When Smith and his team hiked to Nine's last known location, they discovered that she had denned, nothing more than a hastily dug depression in the earth, and apparently given birth, though she and the pups were nowhere to be found. It was as disastrous a turn of events as Smith could have imagined, but he wasn't easily deterred. Tall, lean, and handsome, with a thick head of unruly brown hair and a handlebar mustache, he was not just a wildlife biologist, but a mountain man as well, someone who could design a study and turn out a well-written paper, yet was equally in his element hunting elk or hanging out the side of a helicopter buzzing just over the treetops with a tranquilizer gun in his hands. Smith called in Carter Niemeyer, the best tracker he knew, to lead the search for the pups. Niemeyer was very familiar with Nine and Ten. He was the one who had brought them down from Canada in the first place. Prior to joining the Yellowstone Wolf Project, as the reintroduction effort was known, he'd spent his career as a government trapper, killing nuisance animals for farmers and ranchers, and as a professional taxidermist. He had been a curious hire for a program designed to bring predators back to the landscape, but Fish and Wildlife had needed someone who could gain the trust of the local trappers in the remote backcountry of western Alberta. Niemeyer, who had skinned thousands of coyotes in his lifetime, along with the occasional wolf, was the man for the job. Not that it was easy. Suspicious of anyone who wanted a live wolf, the trappers challenged Niemeyer, then 48 years old, and an imposing 6'5", to prove his backwoods credentials. He found himself on the floor of a trapper's cabin on the edge of the woods, knife in hand, as he and one of the locals, both drunk on homemade chokecherry wine, raced to see who could skin a freshly killed wolf the fastest. Niemeyer won the contest and came back with the wolves the project needed. Now, scrambling across the side of Mount Maurice, grunting like a mother wolf looking for her pups, Niemeyer at last heard the whimpering and squeaks he was seeking, deep under a pile of talus. The search party pulled 8 puppies out of the rocks and returned them, along with their mother, to the park, where they became known as the Rose Creek Pack. As his collar indicated, 10 was indeed dead. He had been shot by a local man named Chad McKittrick, who, after being arrested and charged with a federal offense for shooting an endangered animal, claimed he had thought he was shooting a feral dog. It wasn't the perfect crime. A friend of McKittrick's had disposed of 10's collar in a culvert filled with spring runoff, not realizing that it was, of course, perfectly waterproof and still transmitting. The defendant was anything but repentant. While out on bail, he rode his horse down the middle of Red Lodge in the annual 4th of July parade, wearing a T-shirt that read, "Northern Rockies Wolf Reduction Project." McKittrick's defiance made him a bit of a local hero to some. When a federal judge sentenced him to 6 months in prison, it only reinforced what many in the area thought about wolf reintroduction and about the federal government in general. Overreaching bureaucrats in Washington had rammed wolves down their throats, and people weren't going to just stand by and do nothing. In the years that followed reintroduction, the project spawned a great many papers in academic journals, though Rick himself had never written one. Born and raised in rural Massachusetts, he had joined the Park Service shortly after graduating from college with a degree in forestry, but he was an interpretive ranger by training, not a biologist. That meant he'd spent his 30-year career talking to park visitors and helping them understand what they were seeing. He'd started work as a seasonal ranger in 1976, spending most winters in West Texas at Big Bend National Park and summers in Denali National Park in Alaska. Life as a seasonal ranger meant being satisfied with less. You couldn't have much in the way of possessions, since you had no permanent residence, nor could you make commitments or form long-term relationships. Not that there were many people around to get close to anyway. Both parks operated with minimal staff. Even getting news from the lower 48 was difficult in Denali, which covered 2 million acres but was serviced by only one road. Rick lived by himself in the basement of the visitor center, 66 miles from the nearest highway. It wasn't for everyone, but it suited Rick's temperament perfectly. He had always preferred his own company. By the early 1990s, when Yellowstone's reintroduction plan was beginning to take shape, Rick had already spent countless hours watching wolves in Denali. He'd seen his first wolf deep in the park's roadless backcountry and become obsessed, spending all his free time watching and photographing them. In 1993, he published a book of his wolf photos, pairing them with essays he had written about the prospects for wolf reintroduction at various national parks. He was following the progress of the Yellowstone Project from afar, as it slowly moved through the federal bureaucracy. After the park had gone nearly 70 years without wolves, Rick knew that Yellowstone's Naturalist Division didn't have any interpretive rangers with relevant experience. He convinced Yellowstone's brass that he should be their first-ever wolf interpreter. And after 15 seasons in Denali, Yellowstone became his new summer home. Rick arrived in May 1994, less than a year before the first wolves were scheduled to be released, and found a community deeply divided about the wisdom of reintroduction. Over time, he came to know which gas stations, restaurants, motels, and curio shops were run by pro-wolf proprietors, and which were anti-wolf. The downstairs gift shop at the airport in Bozeman, Montana, where most Yellowstone visitors landed, stocked all things wolf, stuffed animals, knick-knacks, calendars, posters, while the upstairs shop, near the gates, had nothing. A wolf-loving friend of Rick's had once asked the woman at the upstairs counter why. After some hedging, she finally put her cards on the table. "Because we don't like wolves, that's why," she said. In some cases, entire communities were considered to be on one side or the other. Rick rarely drove into the mountains just east of the park, for example, even though he knew Yellowstone wolves often ranged as far as Crandall. He knew Crandall was elk hunting and cattle ranching country, and wolves weren't popular there. Rick's yellow SUV with its telltale antenna was easy to spot, and he worried that locals might follow his movements in hopes of getting a shot at a wolf. In its early years, the project had lost at least 3 wolves to poachers in Crandall. It had become known as a place where Yellowstone wolves ventured and did not return. Rick himself lived in a cabin about 20 miles northwest of Crandall, in the tiny mountain town of Silvergate. The town was just outside the park's northeast entrance, the one least used by tourists. In the summer, it had perhaps 25 full-time residents. Most of them headed for lower elevations before the onset of winter, which began in mid-October and lasted at least 5 months. Rick had seen his share of snow in New England, but winter in Silvergate was different. Situated in a narrow valley at 7,500 feet, the town averaged about 17 feet of snow per year, and it wasn't unusual for Rick to wake up to temperatures of 30 below. He never quite got used to it, but he had learned to make accommodations. Each of his gloves had a pocket near the wrist that held a 9-volt battery which powered tiny electric filaments to warm his fingers and stave off frostbite. He flattened the snow in front of his cabin with his SUV on a daily basis, lest so much accumulate that he couldn't get out at all. Plows kept the road westbound from Silvergate into the park open, but the road eastbound was closed beyond the neighboring hamlet of Cook City. Silvergate in winter was the kind of place you really had to want to be. If you loved wolves, though, nowhere else even compared. When wolves were first brought back to the park, the leaders of the Wolf Project chose a broad river valley in the northeast section of the park called the Lamar Valley as one of their release points. The valley was almost always filled with elk, making it prime wolf habitat. It was also relatively treeless, offering researchers a good chance to observe wolves hunting prey on open land, something that had rarely been seen in the wild. The Lamar Valley had a road running through the middle of it and was popular with park visitors, and researchers figured the wolves might quickly disappear into the park's vast interior, where regular observation would require a lengthy horseback ride, or, more likely, a plane. Some of the wolves did leave the valley, but, to everyone's delight, a few stayed put. They didn't seem to mind the road or the people. And Yellowstone's wolves multiplied just as fast as Smith and his team had hoped they would. By the winter of 2003, the 15 wolves released in 1995, along with an additional 17 introduced a year later, had become a population of 174, divided into 14 packs spread throughout the park. As anticipated, scores of others had left Yellowstone to colonize the surrounding mountains, including Grand Teton National Park to the south, and protected wilderness and national forest land in eastern Idaho and southwestern Montana, areas that had been wolf-free for decades. As part of the same project, wolves had also been returned to a wilderness area in central Idaho, and that population was flourishing and dispersing as well. Wolves dispersing south from Canada, meanwhile, had recolonized a wide swath of northwestern Montana centered around Glacier National Park. Now, just 14 years after the first pens were opened in the Lamar Valley, the wolf population in the northern Rockies had grown to over 1,700 animals. Catching a glimpse of a wolf in the wild anywhere else, even for a biologist engaged in full-time fieldwork, was rare. But in Yellowstone, the possibilities for groundbreaking research were endless. Rick had once hosted a visiting researcher from Wisconsin who studied wolves in the thick forests of the upper Midwest, the one area in the lower 48 where gray wolves were never fully extirpated. His method was essentially the same as Rick's, following radio-collared wolves all day using telemetry and trying to observe them through a spotting scope. After a week of amazing viewing in the Lamar Valley, Rick asked his excited visitor how often he saw wolves back home. The researcher thought for a moment. Last year I saw wolves maybe 5 or 6 days, he said. The rest of his time was filled with following tracks and collecting scat. Things weren't like that in Yellowstone. It had been almost 9 years since a day had passed without someone spotting a wolf somewhere in the park. Yellowstone was a wolf-watching mecca. As Rick watched O6 and her companions eat, their muzzles bright red in his scope, he noticed a pair of skittish coyotes eyeing the carcass warily. The coyotes were less than half the size of the wolves and not nearly as fast, but they were hungry, and one of them eventually edged closer to the feeding wolves. The male wolf leaped to his feet and lunged at the coyote, which ran tuck-tailed and panicked across the snow. When he was satisfied it would not return, the wolf made his way back to his meal. Rick made a note of it on his recorder and went back to watching. His field notes, which he typed up on his computer in his cabin every evening, were nothing if not meticulous. Each day's report began with a summary of the weather, followed by brief descriptions of behavior observed throughout the day, each labeled with the time of day and the exact duration. He considered his research to be in the tradition of the great naturalist Adolf Murie, the first biologist to undertake a steady observation of wolf behavior in the wild. Murie carefully documented the activities of a Denali pack for 2 consecutive denning seasons, and reported his findings in a 1944 book that was now considered a classic. During the 15 summers Rick spent in Denali as a seasonal ranger, he came to know the descendants of the same pack that had been watched by Murie decades before. Rick, who had once gone 891 consecutive days with at least 1 wolf sighting, had in essence turned his life into a field study. He had more than 8,000 single-spaced pages of notes, his life's work, saved on his computer. He had never printed out the entire thing. His ancient printer likely wouldn't survive the task, but he did have a couple of years' worth of notes compiled in red 3-ring binders that he sometimes got out to show visitors. When he had enough notes, he would start his own book about Yellowstone's wolves. Suddenly, all 3 wolves bolted from the elk carcass. O6 sprinting across the snow as though she were a spooked coyote herself. Rick scanned the landscape with his scope and spotted 5 black wolves approaching from the north. It was the Druids. The carcass was on the west end of Little America, which was more or less agate territory, but the Druid Peak Pack made regular forays into the area from their stronghold, the Lamar Valley, 5 miles to the east. Now the Druids had arrived in force, and O6 had to surrender her prize, which would have lasted the 3 wolves a couple of days at least, after only an hour of feeding. Rick recognized the white muzzle of the Druid Alpha male, known as 480, along with White Line, the uncollared Alpha female. Eventually the entire pack came in to feed. Black Bar, Dull Bar, Thin Female, Triangle Blaze, 691, and 690. Rick was happy to see them. He had spent more time watching the Druids, one of the original packs brought down from Canada, than any other pack. Everyone had. Ensconced in the sparsely wooded Lamar Valley since the early days of reintroduction, the Druids were the easiest pack to spot for researchers and park visitors alike, making them the face of the reintroduction program for over a decade. And there were lots of them. In their heyday, the Druids had numbered 37 wolves, one of the largest packs ever recorded anywhere in the world. As the stars of the show, the Druids did not disappoint. Defending the valley against invading packs, running down countless elk, raising litter after litter in their den on Druid Peak, all within view of an audience of visitors that grew bigger every year. Rick began taking notes on the pack when they were first brought to the park, and he never stopped. Rick leaned into his scope and hunched his shoulders against the biting wind. O6 was now long gone, but he zeroed in on the carcass, and his scope was soon filled with familiar faces. Every wolf in the pack was like an old friend, just as their parents had been, and their parents' parents. Watching from the roadside in the Lamar Valley, he'd seen generation after generation of druid pups leave the den, follow adults on the hunt, find their place in the pack, learn how to be wolves. As always, he found himself absorbed by the tableau on the other side of his eyepiece, drawn into the world where nothing mattered but the welfare of the pack. He was hungry, his feet were freezing, and he was more than a little worried that O-6 wouldn't survive the winter. But at least there were wolves in his scope. Chapter 2. In the Valley of the Druids. Rick had been tracking O-6 for only a short time, but he knew her lineage well. Her grandmother had been one of the park's most celebrated wolves, the druid alpha female known as 42, which made her a descendant of Yellowstone's canine royalty. Over the years, at least a half dozen of 42's female pups had become alphas in their own right, in packs spread across the park. Rick had seen them all come of age, each rising to the top in her own time and place, and he saw the same potential in O-6, despite the perilous circumstances in which she currently found herself. O-6's story began where all good Yellowstone wolf stories began, in the Lamar Valley. The Druid Peak pack had held the territory for so long that it was hard to imagine one without the other. But for those long-time observers, like Rick, who could remember the pack's beginnings, nothing about their rise had seemed inevitable. The Druids were among the second group of wolves brought to the park from Canada in 1996. The original pack consisted of a large gray male known as 38, his mate, and three yearling daughters. When they were released into the Lamar Valley, it was already home to the Crystal Creek pack, which had been introduced to the valley the year before and had never strayed far. The park had millions of acres of unoccupied habitat, and the hope was that the newcomers would roam until they eventually found their place alongside the handful of other packs that had established themselves in the northern range, the 57-mile-long mountainous stretch between Gardiner, near the park's northwest entrance, and Silvergate. But the Druid Alphas preferred to stay in the valley and fight. One morning in May, scarcely 3 weeks after the Druids had been released from their acclimation pen, project biologists detected a mortality signal from the collar of the crystal alpha male. Nobody witnessed the battle, but the dead wolf's bloodied carcass told the tale well enough. The Druids had killed him. The crystal pups were missing as well, presumably killed or scattered. The alpha female, injured and desperate, retreated into the park's interior with what remained of her pack. Another conflict soon followed. Exploring the western edge of their new territory, the Druids encountered the Rose Creek wolves. Once again, the bold new pack attacked. This time, Rick was present for the melee, and he watched as the Rose Creek alpha male defeated 38 in single combat, driving the Druid alpha and his pack back into the Lamar Valley. The Druids had emerged unscathed, however, and managed to kill a Rose Creek yearling in the process. The Druids' early battles, the first territorial conflicts witnessed since reintroduction, made Rick and his colleagues see Yellowstone's landscape in a new light. From a wolf's perspective, the Lamar Valley was a territory worth fighting for. Doug Smith had assumed there would be a certain amount of friction as the newly introduced wolves sorted out their various territories, but actually witnessing the conflicts, thrilling to see but chastening in their sudden violence, was more than project biologists could have hoped for. Although it was hard to lose wolves they had invested so much time and money into relocating, the conflicts served to divide Yellowstone's untapped wolf habitat into discrete units, each big enough to support one pack. Wolves fighting other wolves was part of the natural order of things. In early December 1997, the pack, which now included five nearly full-grown pups and an unrelated male who had recently joined, journeyed up over snowy Mount Norris at the eastern end of their territory and into the high country that divided Yellowstone from the Shoshone National Forest. They were far beyond the range of telemetry equipment, and following them through that country, ridge after heavily wooded ridge riven by plunging valleys lined with frozen creeks, was unthinkable in winter. Coming down the other side, the wolves followed Crandall Creek as it wound its way toward the Clark's Fork of the Yellowstone River. It was elk hunting season, and hunters on horseback, rifles slung over their shoulders, patrolled the trail that followed the lower reaches of the creek, studying the snowy ground for the tracks of last night's passing game. Both pursuing elk, the wolves and the hunters instead found each other. On December 3rd, Doug Smith got a call from the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, which regulated hunting in the state. An outfitter had found a dead wolf along Crandall Creek and packed him out. His collar identified him as the Druid's Beta male, and he'd been illegally shot. When Smith took the plane up over Norris and into Crandall, he picked up the signal for 38, the Alpha male. He seemed to be holed up at the bottom of a deep gorge that held one of the creek's tributaries. He wasn't dead, but he wasn't moving much either. Most likely he'd been shot, too. Smith and his colleagues debated whether to hike down to the injured wolf, tend his wounds, and relocate him to the park. Ordinarily, they'd let a wolf fend